Hi, welcome to today's episode of The A-Word, presented by me, Kentaro Oe, Director of Design at Adludio. This season, we're talking to our guests about attention, AI, and ad tech, exploring the burning questions, future trends, and challenges surrounding all things creative and advertising. I'm joined today by Gary Stringer. Gary is a Senior Content Marketing Manager at HowNow, a learning platform that brings relevant learning, skills, and knowledge to every employee in the flow of work. He's delivered successful content strategies for a number of brands and has connected with audience through crafty copywriting and search engine optimization. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kentaro.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Gary, can you give us a quick rundown of what you do at HowNow? Maybe give us some insights into some of the latest projects you've been working on. What does your day-to-day look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess my HowNow career splits into two parts. I've been here for almost 4 years now, and we can probably get into this a bit, but the first 2 years was really all about building content for the website and distributing it on LinkedIn. Once we got a bit of an audience and some traction, it moved into let's try new things like podcasts, like boot camps, big guides, big reports. So most of my day-to-day activities revolve around consistent things like the podcast, the newsletter, and then I get to do these fun, bigger projects around sort of every quarter or every half of the year.
Lovely. Love to hear that. It's never a dull day. It sounds like you're always on something.
Absolutely. Else. Yeah.
Really cool. And with HowNow, you know, it's in this field of L&D, learning and development. Can you give us a rundown of what is L&D, just for our listeners? Just give us the background of like what that's about and how that works.
Yeah. I think most people listening who aren't familiar with L&D will be able to resonate with the non-L&D person's experience, which is just being hassled to complete some sort of mandatory training, being sent to some sort of big content library and left to find some stuff to learn for yourself, maybe be given a learning budget, but not given the structure to go out and spend it well to develop the skills you actually need. That was certainly my experience before I joined the L&D industry. At other companies, now what I see our customers do and other companies that are more forward thinking is to try and give people relevant resources to their job in the flow of work, to try and work out where the skills gaps are in their company, the skills people need, and then try and close them with relevant content, to move away from just this perception of here's mandatory training, but actually, how do we empower people to go out and perform even better and drive the company towards its mission? And that is really what I think we're trying to do for our customers by doing things like centralizing all their knowledge in one place so that people can just search when they face a problem, to map skills so they can close the gaps efficiently, to automate the time-consuming tasks. But yeah, for me, what I've noticed since joining this space, it really is about empowering people to perform and to build the skills that keep them relevant and keep them performing in their career.
Interesting. It is a very, you know, like the old way that you just described pre-joining HowNow, like that's what I'm familiar with, right? And it's interesting to kind of hear that it's not just a one-sided, like, here's the training, do it, there's nothing else. You know, there is kind of like a feedback loop of like, what do you want to learn about? And what is important to the organization, and kind of hearing from that side and filtering and providing content that way. I think that's really interesting. Yeah.
And what's nice about L&D is there's a nice overlap with marketing. So the best L&D is driven around context. Like, what is the pain point for the end user? How do I solve that for them the least friction? How do I actually build a nice brand and sentiment around my internal L&D department? So there's really a lot of parallels between marketing, which is why I think I've quite enjoyed working in this space and being able to map like interesting lesson from marketing onto how we connect with learners. So it's really quite an interesting space to work in.
Yeah, definitely. What do you find, you know, most like enjoyable about kind of being in this like intersection of L&D and content creation and marketing, like you said? Like what's something that drives you there?
What's really nice is that one, L&D people are great. Like, they're super open to new ideas. They're really friendly. They're generous with their time, and they're also eager to learn. So what's been really nice for me is I've been able, I think, a few times to impart simple copywriting techniques that will just elevate someone's L&D content to a new level. So that is really the nicest thing for me. I think I've also learned stuff from L&D that I've applied to copywriting, which is nice that it's a two-way street. So The best example is that, and I'm guilty of this, especially earlier in my career, copywriters and content marketers who don't know something a lot of the time pretend they do and just write the content anyway. L&D people are more likely to seek out an expert in their space, an internal expert in their company, and co-create the content with them. So that's actually something I've learned from L&D. Now, when I'm writing content for L&D, I just reach out to these really nice L&D people I mentioned and said, I know you've done this thing really well, or you've researched this topic. Do you have 20 minutes to chat? And then I kind of use their insights and their advice to go away and create great content. So it's been a two-way street.
Love that. It's changing the way we even approach content and how we think, you know. I think that's really cool. In terms of I guess content curation, right? Because HowNow has this massive library of just material. How important is proper content curation in being able to provide, you know, proper L&D resources for companies?
Yeah, I think any L&D pros listening to this will be able to relate with the idea that they're a small team a lot of the time and they're trying to deliver content for a lot of people. And that's how you often fall into this trap of just sign up to a massive online content library and send that to people. But really, what we're trying to do at HowNow is curate relevant learning. So we have a HowNow Plus is what it's called, but it's more of like a bespoke specialist content library where we only bring in experts on one particular topic and get content from them. So that's one way we reduce friction for people. But anyone who's not using HowNow Plus, we also curate a lot of content from the internet with this mindset that not every L&D pro is going to have time to create every piece of content, but they might have time if we curate relevant content to build pathways for people so they can go and access that content. Or enrich the content. This is often the best thing to do. If you can see that there's a relevant blog post that explains something to your industry, your space, to just go and enrich that with the context that makes it relevant to your people and your company. So I think this is some of the ways we help speed up the process of getting the right content to people. So curate the relevant stuff, encourage people to go and add the context, and therefore it does make it more usable without L&D becoming the bottleneck. This is a common phrase in industry, but L&D can become the bottleneck to people getting the content they need. But at the same time, we don't want to end up with a content landfill where we just curate every single thing on the internet and then just dump it on people because then they're looking for needles in haystacks. So one of the nice things we do is enable people to switch on and off different types of content providers, to specify the types of websites that they curate content from, and really just focus on that relevance overall.
Gotcha. That kind of leads into my next question, which is, you know, even outside the realm of L&D, just thinking about content and what content is and who is creating content. I feel like I'm saying content too much, but you know, there's just such a huge influx of this, and you know, it's so easy to create, it's so easy to share. There's just a big stockpile or landfill, like you said. And you know, even outside the context of like L&D, like how can you identify something, a piece of content, that is actually worthwhile and beneficial to a specific strategy or an audience? Like how would you go about that?
It's so hard at the minute because there is just so much content, and we're often in our day-to-day life suffering from the same problem. We're searching for a needle in a haystack. So sometimes the best way to just find the content you want is to go and speak to a person directly. So like I mentioned earlier, if you know that someone is an expert on X, Y, and Z, you could just send them a message and say, can we chat for 20 minutes? I think the hard thing is to find content that meets intent. So if we're searching for a particular thing, I think the best way to go about that is to make your search as specific as possible and see if content exists already. So use the long tail keyword. Don't just type in like best candles, but you know, if you want a particular type of candle, best candles that smell like fluffy towels, you probably end up at the Yankee Candle website. But I think it is becoming more and more difficult to find the thing that meets your intent. And this is why I think it's like over half a page views last less than 15 seconds, because people are suffering with this idea that content is either very badly structured, so I can't skim it and find the thing I need, or it's just not written for the end user's intent. So to be honest with you, I don't think I've settled on one particular way to just go out and find the right thing other than trial and error, because this is probably why I've quite a value add mindset around content, because I'm also fed up of searching for the thing I need and just hitting friction all the time. Whereas I want to just find a well-written piece that makes the value clear, that's written for the end user rather than SEO. And I'm not always sure I can find that thing independently.
Yeah, I could definitely relate to that for sure. What about like the flip side of that though? Like, you know, for the end user, you know, as overwhelming as it is for someone like you who is a content strategist that has to sift through all this, you know, it is the people that are searching. And is it a matter of like adding filters or, you know, making the UI as friendly as possible so that it's, you know, not over them? Like what is there like a sweet spot of like how do you allow for something so vast to be so searchable, I guess.
Yeah, I think if I'm an end user, one thing I would recommend is to first think about the channel. Like, what is the most likely channel for me to find the type of content I need. So how-to content I actually find is much better on LinkedIn, because the way that LinkedIn's algorithm performs, it encourages me to break stuff down into very practical, like step-by-step things, whether that's a well-structured text post or a carousel. So think about that. I mean, if you want like a short tutorial for how to do something, see if you can go to YouTube before you go to Google, because you probably will find nuances between the different types of tools. I think in terms of creating content, just think about the intent of your end user and how you signpost where the different value is. So for example, like have some non-negotiables in your content, like table of contents at the very top, so that when people come to your page, they can see the structure, they can jump ahead to the most relevant part to them. Always make your subheading super clear, so that as people do skim through a post, they can see where the value has been signposted. If you have steps that people need to follow or data points, drop them into bullet points so they're easy to scan. I think it's just about that. And the more you do that, actually, the more you're likely to appear in search, particularly for niche terms, because your subheading will say something like very specific, like, how do I build this thing out in Excel using X, Y, and Z formula? And as we know, when you search in search results now, you don't necessarily just see the title of the content. You see like a paragraph further down that it jumps to.
Yep.
So just think about structuring your content in a way that removes friction and makes the value super easy for people to find. And actually that has a carryover effect to it probably being more optimized for search anyway.
That makes sense. Yeah. You're right. I mean, if the content is presented in a way that is easily done, like the engine will reward that, right?
Yeah, and this is a problem people fall into. They try and write for a search engine, and if you try and do that too much, your content doesn't come off in a particularly readable way, and that feeds all the way back into the algorithm, because the content might rank initially or people might find it, but when the end user experience is terrible and everyone is leaving your page really quickly, no one scrolls, zero engagement.
Yep.
It's actually a signal back to Google that this content isn't useful. So what you want to do is make the end user experience the non-negotiable and just try and follow these guidelines around search engine optimization where they make sense. So like a good example would be, say your blog post is about a recipe, like how do I make eggs Benedict? If it tells you to include it 30 to 50 times, the keyword, you know that's just going to read really poorly for your end user. If it says content around this term normally has about 2,000 words, and you know you can answer it in 500 because most recipes have like a 700 word backstory on the context, then you have to scroll for about a minute before you even get to the ingredients. They're counterintuitive to the end user experience. So if we do follow these SEO guidelines too strictly, the end user experience suffers, and that only feeds back negatively into your search performance anyway. So write for your user first and Google second is the other piece of advice.
Makes sense. I love that. I think someone does need to kind of tell people who are writing recipes that is happening, because
Much, isn't it? You're riding your bike across Italy, you stumbled into a vineyard, you met the owner, he shared the personal recipe. I don't need to know all that. I've got 20 minutes to make my dinner before I go back to my life. So
it's a time crunch. Every second counts. I love that. And I think, like, you know, the types of content, especially that we're talking about just now, that's written by people, you know, there's kind of a strategy that goes into it, and there's a human being behind whoever's creating the content, whether it's written, video, or images. What's your take on AI generated content or LLMs that produce content, you know?
Yeah.
Especially for you, as like, you know, you have a copywriting background. Like, I'm curious what the emergence of all this tech and the ability to kind of generate, how does that play into what you currently do, and what's your take on it?
Yeah, absolutely. My overall take is that people need to be wary of just creating more content because they can, because as we know from our earlier part of the conversation, the issue isn't that there's not enough content. The issue is that people can't find the right content. If you look as well at what Google is continually saying it's prioritizing every time there's an update, like the most recent one was Google will prioritize content that shows firsthand experience. Now, it's going to be very difficult for you to meet that intent with AI, in my opinion. So it's about using it where it makes sense. So the stuff that does need firsthand experience, definitely don't write it using AI. Whereas there's things like, for example, if you want to build out a glossary on your website to try and own a bunch of terms that say, what is X, Y, and Z? How do I do X, Y, and Z? Why does X, Y, and Z happen? Then that could actually work, because there's more of a definition. It's less of a subjective thing. It's more of an objective thing. So that's somewhere where it makes sense to use something like AI. But I think the overall part is that people need to make sure they're not sacrificing the quality of the content just to deliver quantity. And they need to make sure that their goal isn't just output. So another example would be, I use a tool called Riverside for podcasting. It has this built-in thing where if you ask it to, it will automatically create clips. Now, if my goal was just to get clips out there, then it'd work. But when I watch them back, I know these aren't the best bits of the conversation. I know there's much better, more practical, useful advice somewhere else. So if the goal was just to distribute it, then the AI would be helpful.
Sure.
The goal for me is to engage people and to look at how long I retain people on video and the number of people it reaches. So in that sense, it just doesn't make sense for me to use this thing because it does speed up my process, but does it improve the quality of the output? So it's just about this mindset of where can I use it where it makes sense and quality won't suffer? And where can I make sure I use it so I don't just try and reach output as quick as I can without actually thinking like, what is the pain point for my end user? How do I create the thing that stands out rather than the thing that adds to the noise?
Definitely. I love all these examples because I can directly relate, you know, from a visual design standpoint. You know, these tools exist and they save a ton of time. You know, it adds to inspiration. It can spark something by, you know, using generative images, but it's still a tool, at least for now. It's still a tool at the end of the day, and it can only do a certain amount. And I think that's kind of what I'm getting from your side as well. But then I guess, not to get like too dystopian, but like what happens once, you know, like the content, you know, when the generative AI can produce subjective content to a point where like it feels pretty firsthand experience, right? Because like right now you're saying it's great at definitions and that's what we should use it for. And that's what's going to help. But like the actual meat of it, maybe not. Do you see that coming to a point or like, yeah.
It definitely could happen. And I think it could just shift the skill set you need or the things you need to focus on. Like even if AI gets to the point of it can really nail writing for an audience and it feels really human, you still can't skip the part where you go and speak to your customers and your potential customers and learn what problems they're actually facing or the language they use or what it is they're trying to get to, what's their goal state. So there's certain steps that it just cannot replicate. And it might mean that over time, your skill needs to become actually, how do I really nail the pain point and the messaging part and then ask AI to create the content? Or, you know, one thing AI potentially can't do is distribute content. So maybe it does get really good at creating a long form blog post, but what are you going to do with that after? Are you going to create a newsletter? The newsletter can't be exactly the same as the version that you created for the blog, probably because it might be too long. Are you going to put it into carousels that people can swipe through? Could you record a minute video version of some of the key parts from this? So it might be that if the middle part of the content creation gets really sophisticated, I'm still not sure that it can nail the bookends, the problem discovery, the real connection to the customer, and can it nail the distribution? Because we might find, like the example with the video clips, it might be ages until that gets really sophisticated and really useful. So there'll still be a job for you, but it just might mean that your skill set needs to change and you need to focus on the human things, the things AI can't replicate over time.
Definitely. That part I also resonate with. I mean, I think it's that skill shift, right? Of just like, okay, there's a new tool that's a huge game changer, but that doesn't necessarily render anything extinct. I think it's just we need to kind of shift to be able to accommodate it and better steer it. You know, it needs input, it needs direction and a strategic hand kind of guiding it. So I totally hear you on that.
Adaptability and resilience are massive things for any company and any marketing team. You know, the quicker you can adapt and learn to use something effectively, the more likely you are to thrive and seize on opportunities effectively. So I think it is just being mindful. Make sure you don't rush into something before you understand how to use it. Make sure you're not so far behind the curve that by the time everyone else figures out how to use it, you're playing catch up. So there's a bit of a sweet spot thing here. I think it's always a case of don't put all your eggs in one basket with content.
Definitely.
Set up a parameter, a test that you can actually measure if this works for you. And then if you can see the returns on your time and investment, then go ahead with it. You know, don't just be wedded to something for the sake of it or adamant that you're going to keep persisting with a particular tool or a particular way of working. That's the best marketing teams I see are the ones that really jump on stuff at the right time in an intentional way, as opposed to this new thing is really trending. Let's do it.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I guess on the flip side of AI generated content, you know, there's always when it gets to be too good, I think there's a lot of, you know, potential red flags or concerns that could be, you know, that can set off alarm bells in terms of, you know, is this actually helping or is this hurting? Can this be kind of twisted with malintent? I guess for you, I'm curious, in the realm of content, like, is there any specific type of content, whether it's written, visual, or video, that can just lend itself to being potentially misleading or harmful?
Yeah, I guess it's not. Sometimes it's just stuff outside of your control. Like if people can misrepresent certain things you've said, then that could be tricky, I suppose, from an AI perspective. Yeah, I'm not sure there's anything else that's too susceptible to being corrupted. You know, like everything else kind of has context behind it. It's more like I think sometimes quotes can be taken out of context, and that might be the only worry if on that front. But yeah, I can't see any particular ones where anything is massively susceptible to being. Maybe I'm just too naive and believe in positive stuff too much. But I can't see anything that where I really go, that's a massive red flag. Like this could end up being really bad. Yeah, I suppose one thing actually that is tricky is if you're using maybe someone could use AI to write reviews about products, for example, or to misrepresent products that you don't actually know if they how they work or how they exist. You know, like if you're putting together a list of 11 potential companies and you've never used the product, but you could ask AI to do it like that. These are things where there's gray areas around. Is this legit? Should you be doing this? Is this in good faith? You know, I think that's where it probably ex goes into a dark area. Is like what is actually in good faith in terms of representing things and sincerely, and what is actually sensationalized because you've kind of got a buffer between you actually writing it and AI doing it for you, and you've got that scapegoat there if anyone did ever push back.
Definitely. Yeah, all these scenarios, like that's a great example. I mean, all these scenarios, I feel like they're so new. Like these situations are just very new, and like they couldn't have even been created a couple of years ago. So,
Yeah.
on our show, like we talk a lot. We ask this question a lot of just like understanding like what can be done to control it. Like what needs to happen? What safeguards need to kind of be put into place, or be able to kind of be mindful of like what that kind of something that is being twisted, what that can look
Yeah.
like, be able to identify it properly.
Yeah, it's interesting actually. One thing is obviously like deep fakes are not like a new thing, but a couple of years, no, maybe last year there was this tool where it could analyze anyone with a certain amount of podcasts online. It could analyze them and you could therefore create a fake conversation between two people. And that does get tricky, you know. If you have X amount of your likeness and your voice online, there's no guarantee that people couldn't just use that and weaponize that in some way. So I suppose that's the tricky area.
Definitely. Well, if I get a robocall with Gary's name on it
Yeah.
and your voice, then I'll know I'm
It
coming from.
could be a fake.
Yeah. I just have a couple more questions for you. Just in terms
Yeah.
of, forward looking within you're just in the sweet spot, right? Of between L&D and content marketing. For you, like what excites you for the future? Like are there emerging tech or trends that you think that can shape the industry in a different way. What kind of like makes you look forward to the next couple of years?
In L&D, I think it's that we're at a real point where people need to build the new skills they need to survive in the future faster than ever. You know, like the world around us is really changing at an exponential pace. If people don't build the skills they need, you see all these articles all the time. By the year X, this million people will need to be reskilled. There is an element of truth to that. And actually being in the L&D space at this time, there's going to be a real shift, I think, to the content you create just has to help people build skills in many ways. It can't be this like tick box type stuff or no, we gave people access to this course and it's up to them. I think there will be a nice shift towards stuff has to be contextual. It has to help me perform. It has to future-proof my skills and make sure I'm relevant for the future. I guess the thing that I'm really enjoying from a content perspective now is the forcing function that stuff has to be low friction now. So people's attention span was 12 seconds. Now it's supposedly 8. Most people want to the least friction in the content they consume. So, you know, you'll see people creating video clips now that aren't just sections from their podcast. They're like 3 seconds plus 3 seconds plus 3 seconds. So you only get the good stuff. I think by virtue of how the algorithms work and people's attention span works now, we're going to see this shift to people having to just create content that adds value, that is easy to skim on a blog, that I can consume within 1 or 2 minutes. And I only get the best stuff on something like LinkedIn or Instagram or TikTok, that you only take the relevant stuff and put it into your posts on maybe X or LinkedIn if it's in a carousel. So this is the thing I'm starting to spot. People are being forced to actually remove all of the fluffy stuff from their content now and make sure it really just does meet the end user intent. So that's nice because that's kind of the way I've approached content for a while, and it's nice to see that it's becoming commonplace.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I see that parallel in ad tech and advertising as well, right? Where, the big metric that we always talk about is attention. And, that goes directly into how we design things, where it can't take too long to inform or, even to give a brand awareness. Like it just needs to really hit the spot in a way where it's not intrusive, but also enough attention for you to want to interact, So I think I agree. I think it's great that all like the business models are kind of focusing a bit more towards like the user and really taking into their perspective into account.
And one thing that's forced me to do as well is to measure the intent of my content. So rather than just everything being about views, if the content is about being discovered, then I will look at views. But if it's about adding value, then I should look at how long I retain people on a podcast episode or how long they spend on a blog post. If it's about asking people to take action, how much action was taken in relation to the page views. So I think this mindset around like what is the value to the end user has also forced me down this track of looking at the intent of the content when I measure its effectiveness, rather than getting caught up in vanity metrics. This thing's designed to do this. Does it do this? And I found that to be a really useful shift because I'm more objective about the way I look at my own content. And it's easy to look at the metrics that paint you in a positive light. But moving away to this thing about intent, it's like, does it do the thing it set out to do? If it doesn't, I need to improve it. Not like, did 1,000 people listen to this podcast? Good. But if they all left after 15 minutes of the hour, then not good. So I really like this idea. This is another shift that personally I'm trying to implement and do better. But I think it might just be the carry-on effect of people actually focusing on value is now we have to measure in relation to that value as well.
Interesting. I love that perspective. Gary, and I think that's a good place to kind of wrap this up, I think. So I appreciate you being on the show today, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Gary. And for all listeners, please tune in to the next episode of The A Word, brought to you by Abunio.